Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. Today, I will be sitting down with Bob Chapman. Bob is the CEO and chairman at Barry Waymiller Companies and was recently named the number 3 CEO in the world by Inc. magazine. He is the author of Everybody Matters, The Extraordinary Power of Treating Your People Like Family. Bob, I am so honored and humbled to have you with us today. I am a huge fan. I know a lot of people are a huge fan. Barry Waymiller, your name is out there. You guys are really transforming, I believe, the way people are thinking about leadership today. So I'm just so honored to have you with us as our guest.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to share this calling we have to make the world a more caring place.
I love it. Well, let's jump right in. Tell me a little bit about growing up in Ferguson, if you would.
As I look back in my childhood, I would say in terms of where I've come to, my childhood was a very normal childhood. I was an average student in a public school system. Wasn't really turned on academically. I was into kind of a class clown. It's hard to believe, but I was a class clown. And so I wouldn't say that my childhood really shaped the message. So I think of me as a typical Ferguson kid who got in trouble occasionally and had good friends and ended up giving the speech at the graduation of McClure High School in Ferguson. So again, I think back on it, I just was gifted with a positive personality. I've always had this positive outlook on life that's allowed me to get through the many challenges we all experience with thinking that things were meant to be and we can learn from every experience.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that came from? I know that your parents were very instrumental in your life. Was that just Bob Chapman and how Bob Chapman was born?
I honestly think
Mr. Rogers?
I honestly think it was how Bob Chapman was born because I have this eternally optimistic attitude that things happen for a reason. And if we embrace life that way, then we learn from those experiences we had, learn more from the challenges we have than the good things we had. There's an old expression somebody told me one time, you only grow one way when you eat ice cream. Good times do not necessarily make good character. So I would say to you, I was more challenged by the, I grew more from the challenges than I did from the experiences. And again, my dad was, I was not close to my father until I was in my early 20s and I graduated from college. And he was an accountant by background. And when I passed the CPA exam, it was the height of my dad's pride in me because it took him 3 times to pass the exam, and I passed it the first time. So that was the first time he experienced that. And my mother was just a supporter of mine, but I wouldn't say that either. My dad was kind of a pessimist, and my mom was just a simple Iowa farm girl. So I believe some higher power blessed me with these personality traits that have allowed me to deal with the issues I've faced in my life.
Well, there's so much packed in there. I'm a big believer, too. It's not always fun, the hard challenges, right, that we go through, but that truly is where we grow, I believe.
Yeah, there's no question that I look back on my professional, personal career. It was the most traumatic moments of my life that shaped what my life has become. And I look back and say, thank God that I had those challenges or it wouldn't have allowed me to think and grow as I've been able to do to shape the message I've been able to embrace in this journey I've been on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's going to be really encouraging and some hope to some of our listening audience. So Ferguson means a lot of things to a lot of people, but what does Ferguson mean to you today, Bob?
I would say to you that Ferguson means to me good basic values. You know, I believe here in the Midwest, here in Ferguson, here in the St. Louis area, the thing I would say to you, it's a wonderful place to be raised as a family because we have good Midwestern values. And so I would say to you, when I look back on Ferguson with a great deal of pride, I enjoyed my life in Ferguson. We lived in a very simple house, one bath, three bedroom house in Ferguson. It was a very normal life, nothing unusual about my life, two sisters. And so I would say to you that Ferguson just is the foundation for my value system. My parents were from Iowa, which were pretty simple backgrounds. And so I would say to you, there's nothing unusual in my background that would account for kind of the journey I've been on other than good values, good Midwestern values that I think Ferguson embodies.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I do. I think the values here are just, it's salt and light, you know, really. I mean, people
I always tell people it's a great place to raise a family.
Mm-hmm, right. So more people come to St. Louis and start your businesses and move
exactly.
your businesses here, right? So we kind of talked a little bit about it. You became an accountant. You passed the CPA exam. Did you work for Pricewaterhouse?
Yes,
right?
I worked for Pricewaterhouse.
Started with Pricewaterhouse.
And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a partner. If you ask me why I became an accountant, I have no idea. As a teenager, I wanted to be a gentleman farmer. My grandfather was a farmer. I spent my summers on the farm. But when I found out that my longtime girlfriend was pregnant in college, and I was pretty much a barely passing student in my first year in college, I found myself in the accounting profession, you know, pursuing an accounting degree. And I went from that's why I always say the greatest challenge, a tremendous feeling of society judging you when you find out that your high school girlfriend's pregnant when you're 19 years old. When I look back on that, it gave us a phenomenal son, and I went from a equivalent of a barely passing student in college to a straight-A student who graduated with honors. I don't remember ever thinking about that, you know, I felt like a loser because, you know, I went and lived in a trailer court in a little mobile home and where most people lived on campus, and it clearly brought out of me something I didn't know I had, which was academic skills.
Mm-hmm.
I virtually got straight A's after I found out that Liz was pregnant with our child. And it clearly changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a pivot point for
was
you,
a
wasn't
really
it, Bob?
Pivot point.
Mm-hmm.
But again, sometimes you only learn when you look back at something.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I just felt humiliated. You know, what am I going to do? And again, I don't remember thinking this, that I'm a loser and, you know, that my life mm-hmm. is now going to be shaped by this. My response was clearly, I'm going to make something of my life and earn the respect of my son and,
mm-hmm.
and be a good steward of my wife. And mm-hmm. academics were certainly a path to do that.
Yeah, you stepped up. I think it's probably your positive outlook on life, though. Again, probably thinking, you know, things are not, don't happen by accident.
Yeah,
you know?
I couldn't agree more. I look back on the things that have happened in my life and again, many challenges that I've faced. And there's no question that shapes the way I think and who I am and it grounds me because I don't ever forget those experiences.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Did you ever think when you were getting your CPA and you were working at Pricewaterhouse, did you ever think about being a CEO one day?
No. I mean, I think my focus ever since I took up accounting in my sophomore year in college was to be a partner of a public accounting firm. Even though my dad had a background at Arthur Andersen in St. Louis, my dad and I didn't have much of a relationship, so that was never, I didn't think, a factor in my decision. But my dad had invested in the 1950s about $30,000 to make a small investment in this family-owned company that was struggling. And in the 1965 era, a factoring company out of Chicago that lends against your assets offered to lend the company money to retire the Waymiller stock, some small amount of money. And my dad's $30,000 would become 57%. So my dad stepped into a leadership, you know, to owning the company, if you will, our family, in about 1965. But I don't ever remember any interest in the company whatsoever. We never talked about the company because the company was always challenged. Mm-hmm. It was struggling. My dad had poor health. And so my aspirations was a career in public finance. It never occurred to me that I would had any aspiration of being a CEO. I wanted to be a partner in a public accounting firm.
But at some point, your dad invited you into the business.
And yes, what happened?
How old were you?
Well, what happened was as I passed the CPA exam, which was a momentous occasion for my dad because he was a CPA and it had taken him 3 times to pass it. And when he saw this son, who he had mixed feelings about what I would turn out in life, pass the CPA exam in the first sitting, all of a sudden he started talking to me about business. And so he'd called me over and asked me advice and ideas, but I still wanted to be a public accountant. And one day he said to me, "Would you ever consider working for the company? I need somebody I can trust." I had never thought about it, and my mom cried because she said, "You'll two will hate each other, you know, if you work
not
together."
A good idea.
And what my dad and I said is, okay, I said, "Okay, Dad, you're kind of a pessimist, and I'm an optimist. Well, we got to promise each other, and this was critical to our relationship. If something's bothering you, you're going to tell me, and if something's bothering me, I'm going to tell you. That's got to be the foundation." So we began the journey that way, and again, it was so bad when we started that my dad had a practice with his secretary of opening all the mail in the company looking for somebody who might be trying to cheat him. So that's the environment I stepped into in 1969.
A little toxic.
It was, he just had, people had disappointed him, and he didn't feel he could trust his leadership team, so I was a breath of fresh air to my dad, and I came in with unbridled enthusiasm to bring what I had learned in my school education and a little bit of Pricewaterhouse because I'd only been in public accounting 2 years. So that's how my journey began with my dad, somebody he could trust.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about one life interruption. You had another life interruption when you were just 30 years old. Talk to us a little bit about that, Bob.
I was at dinner in St. Louis with my mom and dad, who were leaving to Australia the next day to our joint venture in Melbourne, and had a nice dinner with my dad, and he woke up the next day and died of a heart attack. So at age 30, I went from, and the interesting thing is that dinner that night at the local restaurant, Steak and Shake, my dad had said to me, "You know, you're kind of running the company now. I think you ought to have the title of executive vice president." That's the last thing my dad said to me before he passed away. So I had worked at the company 6 years. I'd been our mind. Because my title was somebody he could trust, I worked throughout the company, and I learned. I always say when you look at a clock, it looks kind of simple. You have two arms. It goes around and tells you time. But underneath that face, there's a lot of gears that have to come together, synchronized to provide accurate time. So I was given the beauty to look behind the face of the business to manufacturing and sales and joint ventures and accounting and supply chain, all the functions that I kind of, my intellectual curiosity took me on. So when my dad passed away suddenly, I was ready. And the beauty is that I think my dad died in October. We were 3 months into our financial year. And the company virtually rarely ever made its budget, struggled, had banking relationships, but they weren't strong. They were okay. So when my dad passed away in October of 75, within the first few weeks, our bankers announced that they were going to pull our loans because, you know, here's this 30-year-old kid.
What does he know?
Yeah, what does he know?
Right.
And in hindsight, you know, my dad passing away, again, it's a little bit like when I found out that my first wife was going to be with child, it dramatically changed. When the banks pulled on me and my dad died within a matter of a few weeks with each other, in hindsight, again, I said, "I'm not going down this way." And I threw my energy into that company immediately. And the balance of the 9 months of the 12 months, the company had the most profitable year in the history of its company. I paid back our debt. The banks all of a sudden had a new appreciation for me. So the company had the most profitable year in its history in the first 9 months I ran it of the 12-month year. And the good news is that we got through the banking issue. And the bad news is I got overconfident. I had such a win so quickly that it appeared that I had kind of the golden touch, which began a journey to building this company to have a future.
Right. That's really interesting, Bob. So, like, what did that do to you internally? Because I've seen that happen before. If you have success too quickly, you can get a little overconfident. You can get a little prideful. Pride's not a good thing. What did it do to you internally, you know, to have that success so quickly?
It gave me a sense of confidence because, again, to have the most profitable year in the 100-year history of the company within the first 9 months of me running the company. And, again, it continued on. So the company was $18 million when my dad died. And within 4 years, I took what I had learned in my MBA program, what I learned from just awareness of business, and I started some growth initiatives to give the company a future. And it looked like everything I touched turned to gold. And the company grew from 18 to 72 million between 76 and 1982, 83. And then everything that it looked like was gold ended up having issues. And not that anybody could see those issues because we were dealing with major corporations with major initiatives and getting tremendous support. The banks were giving us support. You know, and when you've never, the company hadn't grown since the early 1900s when Mr. Waymiller brought
it. That's amazing.
It was an amazing feeling to talk of St. Louis, talk of the organizations, because we're just exploding with growth and solar energy and electronic inspection in Denmark and filling systems with the Miller Brewing Company and serving Anheuser-Busch growth. So every dimension was dramatic. And so it, you know, just like anything, when success seems to come to early, you don't learn as much from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, again, very successful initiatives, but each one started developing challenges, which ended up creating the second, well, actually the third, because, you know, my first wife getting pregnant, then my dad passing away, and now we're at $55 million in sales, and the banks suddenly pulled on me this time in 1983. It was much more traumatic than in 1975
mm-hmm.
because we were much more dependent upon the banks, and it was a dramatic. The bank that one day said to me, "You're one of our most highly valued clients. We believe in you." And the next day they said, "We don't understand what you're doing. We want to pull our loan."
It was
dramatic. Now, again, I always say I learned so much more when I didn't have money than when I did. When the banks made it easy for me to have, when they supported my growth, it all seemed so easy, and the amount of learning was limited. But when the banks pulled on me, and I was paying 22% interest at the time. I'm in prime plus whatever. It was unsecured debt, but very. I learned more in the 9 months it took me to refinance the business than I ever learned in my life.
And that shaped
who we became today.
Yeah, I want to dig into that. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Bob Chapman. Hey everyone, I want to tell you about something so cool going on right now in the Nichols household. Allie, our wonderful daughter and the inspiration for Something Extra, is competing in the Dancing with the St. Louis Stars event this January. Allie will be the Something Extra for the night, and we need your help. Please go to lisagailnichols.com/vote, watch a video of Allie's story, and get all the links to vote. Each vote is $10, and you can vote as many times as you like. All of the proceeds support the Independence Center, a community-based rehabilitation program for adults with severe and persistent mental illnesses. This is a fantastic organization, and voting for Allie is a great way to support the important work they are doing. And we want Allie to win. Pause the show, go over to lisagailnichols.com/vote, and join Team Allie. Well, welcome back, Bob. You kind of left us with a little cliffhanger there, and so we need to tell our listening audience, I mean, what did you do? I mean, here's another life interruption. You weren't expecting the banks to call the loan. So what did you do?
Well, again, I'd had this tremendous trajectory of growth, tremendous awareness in this community, in our industry, of this phenomenal growth from 18 to 72 million in 4 years. And with the full support of our banks, I mean, they basically told me along that journey, make sure you tell us how much money we need so you got the kind of money you need. And when they suddenly pulled the loan because we experienced some issues with each of those growth initiatives and the related financial issues of warranty expense and inventory write-downs, the very bank that supported me in that growth was the first to pull. And so I came back from the meeting with the bank where they told us to grow. And I don't ever, this is where this personality issue helped. I don't ever remember saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? I remember saying, we got to get through this. And the responsibility of a leader in any organization is to give the people in your span of care a grounded sense of hope for a better future. Well, in this situation, dealing with the crisis, and I'll give you an example. I called a meeting in the intensity of this with our global leadership team. And again, we had declined from 72 million to 55 million. But we had some operations in England. And so people came over from England, and I had, you know, about 12 people in our boardroom. I said, well, you know, it's Saturday morning. Let's get a cup of coffee. And my financial director said, you know, Bob, I forgot to tell you, but they repossessed our coffee maker. We hadn't paid them in 6 months. And I said, you know, I don't ever remember liking that coffee. Why don't I run out and get some, and I'll be right back. So I had this positive attitude towards, and we'd have crisis, you know. I remember our personnel director came to me and said, Bob, we haven't paid our healthcare premiums to the insurance company in 3 months. I'm afraid they're going to cancel on us. And my reaction was, well, if they do, we'll just pay the premiums ourselves and we won't use the insurance company. And my family would say, my wife and kids, Cynthia, would say they don't ever remember me coming home and bringing it home to them. Because, again, this positive attitude, we're going to find a way through this. Let's just keep going and be creative. So I would say to you that we spent 9 months being turned down by financial institutions. People would say, oh, well, we could lend you. You've done so well. And then they'd look at it and they'd say, sorry, Mr. Chapman, but we're not able to lend you. Finally, we got what's called asset-based lending out of a company in Chicago called Citicorp because somebody's father used to work in our shipping department, and his son worked for Citicorp, and he went the extra mile to try and make it happen. So we got refinanced 9 months later with I always say, kind of like going in a dark alley with a guy in a dark suit with an envelope. You know, that's what asset-based lending can really be, right. Traumatic. So anyway, we got refinanced after 9 months, but we lived day to day on cash. We negotiated with vendors every day. Can you give me a little bit? I'll give you a little bit of money. I'll pay a little bit more. I mean, it was day to day. What cash came in? What do we have to pay so we can build things, et cetera? And there's a whole book that could be written on what it's like when you don't know every week whether you're going to be able to pay people for working.
Right.
So at the end of that, we got refinanced by Citicorp. It's like having a noose around your neck. The key, I had studied a company called Emerson Electric and a gentleman named Chuck Knight, who had grown Emerson from $1 billion or something to $20 billion through acquisitions, kind of mature businesses. And so I just went to my finance team after we'd got refinanced, and I said to my finance team, you know, I'm proud of our history, our 100-year history, but our history does not give us a future. We need to find a way through acquisitions to create a future for our people. And my finance department said, the obvious thing, Mr. Chapman, I think you forgot something. We only have one problem with that idea. We have no money. Repeat after me, Mr. Chapman, we have no money. Mm-hmm. And again, this is probably the single most important thing I ever did. I looked at my finance team and I said, I didn't tell you I needed money. I told you we need to do acquisitions. And I walked out uninhibited by the fact that I had no money and began doing acquisitions. It's a little bit like saying, I'm going to go shopping, but I don't need a wallet. And so right. What do you buy when you have no money? Mm-hmm. You buy things nobody else wants. And they'll virtually finance you to buy their product.
Sure.
So these series of probably 5 or 6 acquisitions that I did between 84 and 86, and then I brought incredible intensity because every one was a life-defining moment for me, because if any one of them failed, we were dead, because I had no room in our financial. Mm-hmm. And the beauty is that those came together, I put them together, and the idea surfaced again in England that what if we could sell off these acquisitions in the public market and get enough money to pay off our debt and we'd have a new beginning. I thought, that looks like heaven to me, because I was so tired of no credibility with financing. Even the Citicorp people were tired of us. And so I would say to you that was a transformative opportunity for me. But we began to do acquisitions to give our people a future. And because we were so broke, we brought incredible intensity to each acquisition to make sure that they worked. So that's what transformed our company. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we had had plenty of money to do acquisitions, whether we had done as well, because
right.
the fact that if somebody tells you if you're not successful, you're going to die, you'll probably work really hard to be successful. Mm-hmm. So I would say to you that environment of frailty in financial terms caused us incredible intensity to make sure mm-hmm. that these really eclectic acquisitions worked. And it brought out creative things we did to shape broken companies, to give them a better future.
Wow. There's so much in there that I love, because that just turns everything upside down, because you usually do not look for a struggling company to buy.
Right. But the beauty is there's plenty of those out there. There's plenty of struggling companies nobody
right.
wants to buy that I was able to buy.
Yes, that's wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit, because I really want to get to who you are today and who Barry Waymiller, because like I said, I feel like that right now, Barry Waymiller, there's so much great buzz out there. You guys are the gold standard as it relates to how to lead and the leadership model. So I want to get to this, but, you know, this is called Something Extra. So, Bob, what do you think is the something extra that every leader needs to be a great leader?
I'd say the something extra that every leader needs to be a great leader is what I was blessed with by some higher power, which is to see people in a different way, to see them. And again, I think the most transformative revelation I had was that wedding story where stopped. Many of your listeners will have had the experience of seeing your child wed to another child and having great hopes for the marriage. And so I was experiencing this wedding. And again, as I saw my friend walk his precious daughter down the aisle, and as he got to the altar, he said, "Her mother and I give our daughter to be wed to this young man." And he sat down next to his wife with a great deal of pride, watching the ceremony continue. And my mind, as you can sense, went to a different place. And I said, that's not what that father wanted to say, having walked my two precious daughters down the aisle. What that father wanted to say when he got the elder is, "Look at young man. Her mother and I brought this precious young lady into this world. We've given her all the love that we can possibly give so she can be who she's intended to be. And we expect you, young man, through this marriage, for you to continue to care for her as she will care for you so you can both be who you're intended to be. Do you understand that, young man?" And all of a sudden, I said to myself, oh my goodness, all 12,000 people that work for us around the world are somebody's precious child, just like that young lady and young man. And because until that point in time, I saw people that work for me as functions. That's a receptionist, that's an engineer, that's an accountant, that's an IT person. I didn't see them as somebody's precious child. And I would say to you that that transformed me, because when I realized that, it changed my whole view of the stewardship of the people whose lives are entrusted to me. Because when you think of people not as function but as somebody's precious child, and you know that you've got them in your care for 40 hours a week and that you will be the most positive influence on their life, it changes everything when you stop seeing people as functions. You know, I always say I took a management classes in college. I got a management degree and I got a job in management. So what did I try and do? I tried to manage people. And it was always about me and my success. I was never taught to care for the people I would experience in my journey toward, in my life. I was taught to use people for my success, because we define success as money, power, and position. And I know many people with all three who are miserable in their lives, because that is not a truly successful life. You know, it was interesting to me, after I was interviewed for an article in a magazine, the writer said to me, "Name three people you'd like to have dinner with." I'd never been asked that before, so I thought of him, and I said, "Well, there's a guy named Ken Blanchard who wrote a book called The One-Minute Manager. He's a very man of deep faith, very simple ideas on leadership." And I thought, boy, I'd love to have dinner with Ken. He's still alive. I said, "Number two, I'd love to have dinner with Ronald Reagan. He believed in the goodness of people. He had a vision for our country. He led it with simple elegance." And I said, "Do I get three?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, then I'm going for the big guy. I'd like to have dinner with Jesus Christ." You know, what a cool guy to have dinner with. And so that was published, and this still amazes me. But within 2 months of that article being produced, the people I tell you about did not know about the article, but a gentleman emails me. His name is Ken Edelman. He worked for Reagan in the White House. He helped negotiate with the Russians the Strategic Arms Corps. Ken emails me and said, Bob, I just watched your TED Talk, and Ronald Reagan would love the wedding story. And I thought, well, you know, that's about as close as I'm going to get to Reagan. It really touched me that somebody who worked intimately with Reagan for 8 years in the White House reached out to tell me that Reagan would have loved the wedding story. I thought, that's a coincidence that I just named Ronald Reagan. And then I'm at a dinner in San Diego, a leadership guru conference, and a gentleman taps on my shoulder and says, Bob, I just had dinner with Ken Blanchard, and he loved the wedding story, and he wants to talk to you. I thought, oh, my God, that's number two, and I'm not ready for number three yet. And it was astounding to me that I had said that in the article, and these voices came out all related to people who I would love to talk to about this journey we've been on from success to significance. So I would say that the wedding story is, in all the talks I've given around the world, that is the one that resonates with people, because we're kind of taught to use people for our success. We're never taught to care about people, because we define success as money, power, and position, not leading lives of significance in response to his love for us. So I would say to you that the wedding story was the one that really helps people understand, when you look at the people that you have the privilege of leading as somebody's precious child, and you know you're going to have impact on their life,
changes everything. Absolutely. I love that. I'm so glad that you were able to to meet with Ken, and that's wonderful. Yeah. So, Bob, there's a couple things that I love that you say. One of the things is people will say, you know, what do you build? What do you do? And I love your quote, we build great people. I love that. Another one that I know that I'm going to carry with me personally is that always look for the goodness in people. And there's goodness in everyone. There's goodness there. Sometimes you really have to look hard for it, but, you know, there definitely is goodness. So I love those two things, and those are quotes that I'm going to take with me. But talk to us a little bit. I mean, you've been given this amazing gift. Barry Waymiller, like I said, has just kind of turned things upside down in terms of how you lead. What are you doing with this gift that you've been given? Is there something you want to talk to our listening audience about and how they can get more connected and learn more?
You know, I think a couple of things that come to my mind. One of the things that I was blessed with in this journey, revelation, was that probably 10, 12 years ago, somebody encouraged us to do a video about our unique company. And this is when we were much smaller and much less evolved in our thinking than we are today. And it was during the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal. It was during the Enron scandal. So if you go back to that environment, it was kind of disappointing for our country and our political leaders and our business leaders. So, but we had been challenged to do a video of our company's success. And so the marketing team had done all these nice expressions. They're getting towards the end of the video, and they came to me and said, we want to talk about our success, growth in sales, growth in profits, growth in customers. And the burden of kind of where we were as a country in terms of trying to look up to leaders, but these issues had developed. And a thought occurred to me that has profoundly shaped what I'd like to share with listeners. I said, you know, we define success all wrong in this country. We define it as money, power, and position. We are going to measure success by the way we touch the lives of people. And that became our guiding principle, measuring success by the way we touch our team members, we touch our customers, we touch our community. We don't beat up suppliers, you know, we don't take advantage of people. We are going to measure success by the way we touch the lives of people. And that became kind of the foundation of our belief system, of our values, and everything needed to. We could look at that statement and make decisions all day long about caring, well-being, stewardship, because we had this now, this expression, we measure success by the way we touch the lives of people. I'd also like to add that when Washington University sent over two organizational development professors a few years back to interview me because they'd heard about this, and they interviewed me for about an hour. At the end of the hour, they said, you know, you're the first CEO we've ever talked to that didn't talk about our product. And I thought a moment, and I said, we've been talking about our product for the last hour. It's our people. I will not leave this earth proud of the machines we build. I'll be proud of the lives we built. These thoughts that developed over this period of time really shaped this feeling that we've been blessed with, a leadership model that could profoundly change the world as we know it. And I believe it's the way we were intended to live and work together, where people validate the worth of each other in their journey, and that successful lives are those people who serve others in their pursuit of significance. And so I would say to you what we've done, because we feel that we've now, some higher power chose us to show the world the way we are intended to live and work together, where we value each other and care for each other. So we not only teach within internally how to transform managers into leaders. And again, a lot of my leadership practice was shaped by trying to be a parent and trying to be good to the six kids we were blessed with. At the same time, I was trying to fix this broken business, which I told you about previously, which is about management, which I define management. The word management means the manipulation of others for your success. And leadership is the stewardship of the lives entrusted to you to ensure. And people talk about needing to find people, you know, good people to bring your organization. I believe it's a matter of building a safe bus, which is your business model. And then you need leaders who know where to go and how to get there safely. And therefore, anybody that gets on the bus is going to go to a good place. So our responsibility as leaders is around people, purpose, and performance. It starts with our understanding that our primary responsibility are the people who we invite to join us around a purpose that inspires them to share their gifts fully towards a common vision. And then we have to create value. If we don't create value, we can't be good to our people. It's a continuous cycle, not two out of three, not one out of three, but all three. People, purpose, and performance in harmony. Human value and economic value in harmony. That is the world the way it was intended to be. And we have been blessed with a model that allows us to create that for the people we have the privilege of leading. And that is our leadership criteria. And so we teach people internally in our university to care, because we realized we couldn't send them back to universities because we teach management and we need to teach leadership. So we created our own teaching content. And then from that, we learned that listening is the most powerful act of leadership. So we have taken from our university to Cynthia and my nonprofit called Our Community Listens, and we have a branch in cities around the country, but we have one right here in St. Louis, where we teach people empathetic listening in 3 days. Because when I thought when you cared for somebody, you went over and talked to them. It turns out when you care for somebody, you go over to listen to them with empathy, to be present, to listen to them. And finally, we decided that this message was so powerful, we needed to share it with the world. And we created the Leadership Institute, where we're looking for early adopters, people who believe what we believe and want to join us on this journey so we can start healing as a country. Because when you look at our country right now with the lowest unemployment in 50 years, peace in the world, and people are not happy. We thought when we had prosperity and peace, we were giving people the ultimate environment. But what we haven't created is a world where people feel valued, because we live in a society where we use people for our success instead of care for people for our success. Together, we can do great things. So we feel that we have this calling to share with the world what we were blessed with, which is a model that cares for the people we lead. So that we found out in this journey that the person you report to at work is more important to your health than your family doctor, okay? And we also, when we teach people to be leaders in our company, 90% of the feedback is how it affects their marriage and the way they raise their kids. And so we realize now that if people are not cared for 40 hours a week, it affects their health and affects their family unit. So business could be a powerful force for good if it simply cared about the way it treats the people they have the privilege of leading.
Yes, and when you think about that, Bob, truly this leadership model could change the world. Because when you are doing that with the people that are entrusted to you, they're going to go home. They are going to be happier at home. They're going to have a more fulfilling family life. And there's just a domino effect there.
You know, there's a church that
generations.
I gave a speech at a church in Charlotte, and they have a program called the Leap of Faith. How do you go from Sunday to Monday? And this is exactly how the book Everybody Matters is how we care for the people that we have the privilege of leading in our life, whether we're at home or we're at work, or we're in our community. And when you think of the issues we face today in our society where people don't feel valued, how can we ever be raising kids today when their parents come home from work not feeling valued? So when my granddaughter graduated 2 years ago from Aspen High School, everybody else was cheering as their 158 students walked up to get their diploma. And I had tears in my eyes because I knew the world we were sending my granddaughter into, a world where 88% of the people don't feel valued. And my hope is that by standing up and sharing on this podcast, preaching wherever I can, this caring message, that we can transform the world to the way it was meant to be, where people genuinely care for each other. And this is not an American issue. It's not a business issue. It's true in every facet of our society. People are hurting because they don't feel valued. We have customers in Russia who come over to look at our equipment and come back, and they want to talk about our culture. They want to bring this culture to Russia. So I believe that this is the answer to the world peace, where people value each other because they feel not used, but valued. So my message is to try and share this in any way I can, and I appreciate this opportunity, your interest in this message, because I feel it's not our message. It's a message a higher power has given us, because it's a message that would heal the world as we know it.
Thank you so much, Bob. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for inspiring us. Thank you for your deep convictions and your willingness to stand up for what you believe is right, because I'm with you.
I had a feeling she was with me.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2018. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit lisagailnichols.com/somethingextra. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen.